Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Intro Biology Podcast. Today we'll be talking about atoms, elements, and compounds. Atoms are the simplest form of matter that we'll come across in biology, and they're comprised of three subatomic particles called protons, neutrons, and electrons. Protons and neutrons are found in the nucleus of the atom, which is the center of the atom, kind of like the center of the cell. And so the center of the atom contains protons and neutrons. Protons are positively charged subatomic particles. Neutrons are neutral subatomic particles, so they have no charge. And the third subatomic particle is called an electron, which is negatively charged, and it is found outside the nucleus, kind of buzzing or floating around the nucleus. And these make up what we call matter. Matter is anything that takes up space and has a mass. So the subatomic particles have a mass. When you combine them together, now the atom has the mass of all of those particles added together. So atoms of a particular configuration are called elements. You can think about this as the thing you break down biological matter into before it becomes subatomic particles. So if you take a protein, you could break it up into molecules, you can break those molecules into elements, but you can't break elements down any farther. If you do, you're getting down to those subatomic particles. And so the elements you might remember from your periodic table are the certain configurations of protons, neutrons, and electrons. And we'll get into that in just a moment. Another term we'll use is a molecule, and a molecule describes two or more elements that have been bound together. Another term that's similar but slightly different is a compound. A compound is two or more different elements that are combined in a fixed ratio. So for example, you might have gases like hydrogen gas, nitrogen gas, oxygen gas. Those are two elements of hydrogen or of nitrogen or of oxygen stuck together. We call this a diatomic molecule. Those are not compounds because they are the same element bound together. A compound is two different elements stuck together. An example of a compound would be something like table salt that you use in cooking or to season foods. And that's comprised of a sodium and a chlorine atom called sodium chloride when they're together. And those always exist in a one-to-one ratio, one sodium ion with one chloride ion coming together. So that would be an example of a compound. Another is water. Water is made up of two elements or atoms of hydrogen and one atom of oxygen. Those are combined in a 2-to-1 ratio, two hydrogens to every one oxygen. So because they're different elements and they're in fixed ratios, those are compounds. You would also call them molecules, but something that's two of the same atom together would be a molecule and not a compound, just to clarify that distinction. What's interesting is that when we start to bring different elements together, those new things that they're creating, molecules or compounds, have different properties than the elements that made them up. So for example, oxygen has its own properties, hydrogen has its own properties, but when you bring them together to form water, water now has properties that are different from either the hydrogen or the oxygen. And we call these emergent properties, properties that emerge when you bring different elements together. Now relating more to biology, certain elements are essential for the functioning of biological systems. For example, humans, there are 25 elements that are essential for human bodies to function properly. Plants have about 17 essential elements. And many of these you will have heard before. The most common and most abundant of the essential elements in humans are oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. Together, just those four elements make up over 95% of all of the mass in a human body. And then there are many other still essential elements that are just a little bit less abundant. So for example, calcium and phosphorus and potassium, sulfur, sodium, chlorine, magnesium, all of these are essential, just less abundant than those big four, oxygen, carbon, hydrogen, and nitrogen. There are still other essential elements, but their abundances are much, much smaller than the ones I just mentioned. We call these the trace elements. These are generally classified as any element that makes up less than 0.01% of the mass of an organism. And so for us, for example, these trace elements would be things like fluorine, iodine, and iron, just to name a few. These are essential, but we need very little amounts of them in order to function normally. Just to give one disease context for this, iodine is essential for normal functioning. And if individuals consume less than the required amount of iodine, they can actually develop some diseases. One of the most prevalent is called goiter. Goiter results when the body has lower than adequate levels of iodine. The thyroid gland in the neck works harder than it has to synthesize the molecules that it needs because there's not enough iodine. And you get the thyroid gland kind of inflaming or swelling in the neck. And people with this disease can be seen with kind of a bulge in their neck from an overworking thyroid gland. So to combat this disease, most countries will sell iodized salt. As an example, this is normal table salt, sodium chloride, that has iodine added to it so that you can get the amount of iodine that you need in your diet. Humans, for example, need 0.15 milligrams of iodine every day. It's a very small amount, and iodized salt is just one way that we're building it into our diets to help out. All right, so to talk a little bit more about atoms, these are kind of the most fundamental building blocks of matter that we're going to come across in biology. You can think of this as like the thing that you break something down to before it becomes something else. So to put that into context, think of a gold bar, for example. Gold has certain properties to it, and if you chop that gold bar up into smaller and smaller pieces, eventually you'll be left with one atom of gold. That will still have the same properties as a bar of gold, but if you were to chop it up just one more time, you've now broken it into subatomic particles that no longer have the properties of gold. So you can think of an atom as the smallest thing you can break something up into that still has the properties of that larger thing before it becomes something else. So as we said, there are three subatomic particles. Neutrons and protons are found in the nucleus, protons having a positive charge, and electrons are found outside or around the nucleus and they have a negative charge. And they are much, much smaller than our protons and neutrons. A few numbers that we use to describe elements. One is the atomic number, and the atomic number describes the number of protons in an atom of a particular element. It's called the atomic number because the number of protons determines what element it is. Another way of saying that, all atoms of the same element contain the same number of protons. Carbon, no matter what form it comes in, has 6 protons always. If it had 7 protons, it would no longer be carbon. It would be nitrogen in that case. So when you see the atomic number, that's the number of protons, and that tells you exactly what element it is. Another important number is called the mass number. The mass number is the sum of the protons and the neutrons found in the nucleus of an atom. Since we know the atomic number and the mass number, you can solve for the number of neutrons, right? You take the mass number, which is protons plus neutrons, you subtract the atomic number, which is the number of protons, and you're left with the number of neutrons. So anytime you're given both of those numbers for a particular atom, you can solve for the number of neutrons. So let's take just as one example, sodium. Sodium has 11 protons, so it has an atomic number of 11, and one type of sodium would have a mass number of 23. You would simply take 23 minus 11 to get 12. So this particular atom of sodium has 12 neutrons and 11 protons. Another term that we use to describe particular atoms is called the atomic mass. Just as the name suggests, this is the mass of an atom. So you would sum the mass of all the protons, all the neutrons, and all the electrons, even though they're so small. That's such a small number because atoms are so tiny that it's not really a number that we can work with very easily. So what we often use instead is called the molar mass. And the molar mass is the mass of 1 mole of atoms. And a mole, if you've learned in chemistry, is 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd atoms, or anything, to make up 1 mole of that thing. Essentially, that's just a ton of it that gives it to a large enough size that we can get a mass that's somewhat workable in our normal normal math and normal equations. And so atomic masses or molar masses would be calculated in grams, so we can kind of visualize how much that is. So anytime you see atomic mass, you're talking about the mass of one atom. The molar mass is the mass of one mole, or lots of the atoms. So as we said, the number of protons is what determines which element some atom is. Even if they have the same number of protons, atoms can still have different numbers of neutrons and still be that element. So for example, carbon can have 6 protons and 6 neutrons. It can have 7 neutrons, or it can have 8 neutrons. As long as it still has 6 protons, it's still carbon. And so what I just described is called different isotopes of carbon. They're different configurations of atoms that have the same number of protons but different numbers of neutrons. So they have the same atomic number but different mass numbers. So carbon 12 means carbon with a mass number of 12. Since it's carbon, you know it has 6 protons. 12 minus 6 is 6, 6 neutrons. Carbon 13 is carbon with a mass number of 13. Since it's carbon, it has 6 protons. 13 minus 6 is 7. It has 7 neutrons. And one more example, carbon 14 is carbon with a mass number of 14. Carbon always has 6 protons. 14 minus 6 is 8. So that is 3 different isotopes or different configurations of carbon. Certain isotopes are less stable than others. You can't just keep squeezing neutrons into a nucleus of an atom. Eventually it gets too unstable to stay together. And so those isotopes that aren't stable are called radioactive isotopes. These are isotopes that will exist for some period of time, but eventually they actually decay or break down. And when they do this, they release energy, they release particles, and they become some more stable isotope or even a different element, depending on how they decay. So all that's to say is that isotopes are different configurations of the same element in an atomic form. Those that are unstable are called radioactive isotopes. Because a certain element will have many different isotopes in nature, it's useful to kind of get a number to appreciate all of the different isotopes and all of their different abundances. Some isotopes are more abundant than others, some isotopes are less abundant. And so a way we can kind of compile all of that information is in what's called the average atomic mass. And the average atomic mass is kind of a weighted average. And a weighted average is where you take the abundance of something as a decimal, you multiply it by its mass, for example, and then you add all the other variations of that thing. So in the context of isotopes, we would take the abundance of carbon 12, multiply it by the mass of carbon 12, plus the abundance of carbon 13 times the abundance of carbon times the mass of carbon 13, the abundance of carbon 14 times the mass of carbon 14, and so on. So you'd add the abundance times the mass of every isotope. When you put all those together, you get a weighted average, or the average atomic mass. So when you look on your periodic table and you see a number with a decimal, so for example, you might see 12.01 as the mass of carbon. That's a weighted average of all of the isotopes of carbon. And since it's so close to 12, you know that carbon 12 must be the most abundant of those isotopes. Like I said, radioactive isotopes, those that are unstable configurations of neutrons and protons, they're unstable, so they're going to decay, and there's actually a term or a number we can use to describe how they decay, and that's called the half-life. And the half-life is simply how much time it takes for 50% of that isotope to decay. And different isotopes for different elements have different half-lives. And it's not super important for the purposes of this discussion, but just know that some things will last longer in their radioactive form and some things will decay very quickly. This has biological relevance because we use this fact of radioactive isotopes in medicine and in research. So for example, if you wanted to know if a patient had a tumor or some cancerous tissue, you could use a radioactive isotope of a normal element and trace where it moves in the body. One hallmark of cancer or any tumor is that those cells do more metabolic activity than normal cells do. So if you essentially feed a patient a radioactive isotope, that cancerous tissue will take up that isotope more than the normal tissue around it. And since it decays and releases energy and particles, different imaging machines can detect that decay, and they can say, oh, in this region of the body, there's more metabolic activity. That might be where a tumor is. You can also use this in research. You can stick a radioactive isotope onto a molecule that you're interested in the cell, and then you can follow it with sophisticated computers and cameras and see where those decays are happening and trace molecules. One other example you might see this in is in dating. If you ever heard that a rock was a certain age, millions of years old, how they calculate that is they know the number of isotopes or the abundance of the isotopes. They know what they should be based on what the current configuration is and what it was in the past. And so they can say, oh, this isotope should be this abundant, but now it's only this abundant. It must have decayed this much, meaning it's this old. And that's called radiometric dating. So just a few examples for why isotopes are actually relevant. So that isotope discussion more focuses just on the protons and neutrons inside the nucleus. Let's talk a little bit more about the electrons outside of the nucleus. Electrons are negatively charged. Protons in the nucleus are positively charged. And what do we know about charges? Opposites attract. So those negative electrons want to be close to the nucleus of the atom, but they're held apart by other forces that we won't talk about here. And when you separate two charges that want to be together, that system now has potential energy. You can think about stretching a rubber band. If I take a rubber band and I stretch it and stretch it and stretch it, if I were to let it go, it snaps back together. So in its stretched out form, it has the potential, has potential energy to snap back together. The same way as separating a positively charged proton from a negatively charged electron. As you separate them, there's the potential to come back together. And it's the potential energy stored in that system that's used in chemical and biological reactions. Electrons, like I said, are outside of the nucleus of the atom, and they're actually at distances away from the nucleus that we call energy levels or electron shells. So these are kind of the average distances that you might find an electron from the nucleus of an atom. The further out, you would say it's at a higher energy level or a higher electron shell. So these electrons that are in these shells outside of the nucleus of the atom, the farther the electrons are away from the nucleus, the more likely they are to participate in chemical reactions, right? They're farther away, they feel less of the pull of the positive charges in the nucleus, and they're just more accessible to start forming interactions with other elements or other compounds. Those electrons that are in the farthest shell, the farthest distance from the nucleus, are called valence electrons. And the shell or energy level that they're in is called the valence shell. And it's these valence electrons that are the ones that are going to participate in chemical reactions and form chemical bonds. One thing that's useful for us is to think that elements with the same number of valence electrons behave similarly in chemical reactions. So for example, if you're looking at your periodic table, the second to last column, you'll find the elements fluorine and below it chlorine. Since they're in the same column, the way the periodic table is organized, they have the same number of valence electrons. And so fluorine and chlorine behave similarly in chemical reactions. Just something to keep in mind if you're looking at elements on a periodic table and considering how they react. All right, one last thing to discuss about electrons is where you find them outside of on the outside of the nucleus of an atom. And where electrons are stored are called orbitals. These are just three-dimensional shapes where the electrons spend their time. And they have different shapes based on rather complicated mathematical equations, but for our purposes you can just think of them as some 3D shape where the electrons are buzzing around the nucleus. They can be spherically shaped, they can be what's sometimes called a dumbbell shape, but I think it's more appropriate to think of it as the number 8 or the infinity sign, where they're kind of oblong circles in three dimensions around the nucleus. Those are called p orbitals, the spherical ones are called s orbitals. Again, more of the chemistry, but just to think and remember, orbitals are where electrons are stored. Two rules to remember for orbitals. The first is that there can be no more than two electrons in one orbital. That's the maximum number. And the second rule is that unpaired electrons, electrons without a second electron in the same orbital, are the ones that are likely to be involved in chemical reactions. When they're unpaired, they're more likely to participate in chemical reactions, and we'll see this in a future discussion. So just to summarize some of the things we talked about today. Atoms are the smallest units of an element. You break them down to one atom, and if you break it down again, you now no longer have that element. And atoms contain protons, neutrons, and electrons. Protons and neutrons are in the nucleus. Protons are positively charged, electrons are negatively charged. Protons are what determine the identity of the element. If it has 6 protons, it's carbon, no matter how many neutrons it has. If it has 7 protons, it's nitrogen, no matter how many neutrons it has. So the protons are what determine the identity. Something else you might have picked up on is if protons and electrons are oppositely charged, then their ratios will determine the overall charge of the atom. If you have the same number of positive and negative charges, you're neutral. Every positive cancels out every negative. If you should have more electrons than protons, you have extra negative charges, and therefore you're overall negative. And if you have more protons than electrons, you have more positive charges, and then you're overall positive charged. These are called ions when you have an unequal number of protons and electrons. Isotopes, we mentioned, are different configurations of the same element, so same number of protons with different numbers of neutrons. Some of them are unstable, and we call those isotopes radioactive. They decay. Electrons are negatively charged particles outside the nucleus of the atom, and they're found in orbitals, three-dimensional shapes. And you can only have two electrons at a time per orbital. And unpaired electrons are the ones most likely to participate in chemical reactions. And the electrons that are farthest away from the nucleus are the ones most likely to participate in chemical reactions.